From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Nice to have you. Tonight, we're going to start off with thoughts on Whitney Houston. Yeah, I don't know. Have you been paying attention? The iconic female singer passed away. Lots of rumors out there as far as causes of death. Waiting for some toxicology reports. I think you and I can put A plus B together and probably get C as far as what happened. But what we're going to do is we're going to bring on Wendy Murphy here in a little bit. You all know Wendy is a former sex crimes prosecutor, crime analyst on many of the cable news networks, and a law professor, to talk about Whitney's death, how it's been covered in the media, and is Whitney Houston a poster child for life? Or is she a poster child for what can go wrong in life? And then we're going to talk with Wendy about the Powell case, the tragedy. Should those little boys have ever been brought to their dad for a visit? And who's at fault? Is it the judges? Is it social services? Of course, Powell himself can be blamed for this, but is there something wrong with the system? So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back here in just a minute or two with Wendy Murphy. And then a little bit later on, y'all know Clint Van Zandt, Dr. Clint Van Zandt, former FBI agent, hostage negotiator, and we'll continue on talking with Clint about the Powell case and all your stories and what's been happening in the last few weeks here on Scared Monkeys. So we'll be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. It's always a pleasure to have Wendy Murphy on the program. Hi, Wendy.
Hey, Dana. Good to be with you again.
Nice to have you. We're going to talk about the tragic Powell case here in a little bit and your recent article for the Patriot Ledger. But I want to get your thoughts a little bit on the Whitney Houston situation, and I've talked to you a little bit in advance before the program, and we're not going to talk so much about her death. We can all probably put A and B together to get C as to why she died, but let's talk a little bit about the coverage. And we've heard Bill O'Reilly, who you are close with and a regular guest on his program, talk about how the media covered the Houston case. You know, we've seen the 3.5-hour funeral. Some state leaders don't get that coverage in the media. Is Whitney Houston a poster child for the life she lived, or is she a poster child for the life we don't want our kids to live?
Well, good question. You know, maybe both. You know, the things that that make us pay attention are not always the things that we feel proud about. And I think as human behavior goes, it's fair to say that we sometimes are riveted by stories that make us feel scared, that we perhaps align ourselves too closely with, and we see ourselves and we, you know, don't know what to make of it. And then there are other stories where we're just riveted by the horror of humanity, and we have no sense of why people behave the way they do or do the things they do, but it's so shocking and distant from us that we pay attention. So I think, you know, Whitney Houston, for me, and the nature of her death and the press coverage, you know, Bill sees it. It's a different view of mine, but Bill sees it as we glamorize certain people, and when we glamorize them, we don't tell the truth. And there's something to that, no yep. question. My piece about Whitney, which, by the way, is running this weekend at patriotledger.com. It'll run on Saturday. I think it'll be online on Sunday, hard copy on Saturday, is the argument that I make is that we should talk collectively about the way that we claim to live in a culture where we care about one another and that we're supposed to, sort of be pushy about our collective values. We impose on each other because there's a social contract where in exchange for the benefits of society, you also have to have certain burdens, and those burdens include reaching out to people who are in trouble. Well, in some contexts, we understand that. Homelessness, for example. When someone is homeless, we are only too ready to offer up solutions, and, you know, we'll give people money, and we feel obligated, and this is all good. We even give government money to protect people from themselves when the scourge of their lives is related to homelessness, even if that includes drug abuse and so forth. Why we don't feel the same compulsion to help people when the person who's suffering from drug abuse or drug addiction or alcohol addiction is wealthy and famous, I don't understand. In other words, my piece is all about why didn't more people impose themselves into her life and save her from herself? And is it a liberal ideology? Is it a libertarian ideology? What is it that restrains us from butting into people's lives? I'm not saying she could be saved, because lots of people with addiction can't be saved. But I feel pretty strongly that even if she didn't want help, we have an obligation to impose ourselves on people who are suffering. And the reason that we don't is because it scares us. We see in Whitney Houston's eyes our brothers, our mothers, our sisters, our children, and we look away because it's the easier alternative. And when you look away, people die, and that's what I think happened to Whitney. I know people say, well, she had enablers, and she was wealthy, and people just let her do what she was, like a Michael Jackson, blah, blah, blah. I don't care.
Yeah.
The point is we look away because it's easier on us, and that's a pretty sad excuse for letting a person self-destruct. I think everybody knew she was moving toward self-destruction, and so many people said, I'm not surprised. Well, you know, if you're not surprised that she died the way she did, then what the hell were you doing letting her die? That's kind of how I feel about it. So I disagree to some extent with Bill O'Reilly. I love Bill.
Yeah.
I've known him for a long time. But I think, you know, if I were in charge of the world, I would find a way to require us to reach out a little bit more. Addiction is a terrible, terrible illness. Yes, people should have more personal responsibility, but addiction trumps personal responsibility. People who want to get better sometimes can't. It's not that they choose to stay sick. They can't choose to get well.
Yeah, one more quick question about that. Wendy Murphy's here. That term enablers is an interesting one. We hear that lots with Michael Jackson, Anna Nicole Smith, and you name it. Back to Elvis, for heaven's sakes, and before that. And the system in doctor shopping, and who knows what will happen with Whitney Houston. And I agree with you, and I agree with O'Reilly somewhat in both cases. But when we look at the system, and we look at how it has failed, and there are lots of Whitney Houstons that may be named Jane Smith or Bob Jones that we don't hear about in the media, but what about the system, these enablers and doctors and the scourge of prescription drugs and how it's killing people?
Yeah, well, that's part of why I wrote what I did about Whitney. You know, I'm not so worried about Whitney Houston and those of her ilk in terms of wealth. I'm worried about the majority of folks who have no money and are being allowed to self-destruct in similar ways. You know, doctor shopping, as you put it, means very simply that people who are addicted know that you can pick up the telephone and call Dr. A, Dr. B, Dr. C, get what you want, and that they will, in a sense, be deliberately blind to the reality of what else you're doing. In other words, you know, if Dr. B says, well, I didn't know she was also getting drugs from Dr. A, then everybody gets to walk away unscathed. They don't get in trouble because they can claim that they didn't know this addict was shopping around for drugs from different doctors. Well, if that's true, if that's what addicts do, then we have to have a system that doesn't allow it in some way. And, you know, some states have stepped up and some states have laws in place that are pretty good, but they're not enforced. Overall, however, we live in a culture where even if we could all agree that doctor shopping is a problem for addicts and that they are dying in numbers that we should care about because of doctor shopping, we could pass all sorts of laws to forbid it. We still wouldn't necessarily have the political will to enforce it because we are chock full of liberal and libertarian ideology that compels us to believe that there's freedom at stake for this person, that we should respect their freedom to choose to self-destruct. And, you know, it's an American value system that I have trouble with. If we really care about the concept of, you know, not so much I am my brother's keeper, but that we want to live in a nation of ordered liberty and not pure chaos, then ordered liberty means, you know, you can't just do what you want. You can't just kill yourself if you feel like it. We are going to stop you. And we do it in other ways. Dana, if you feel like jumping off Niagara Falls in a barrel, you can't. You just can't. We would stop you.
Sure.
If you feel like making your home and out of asbestos, if you want to use asbestos to build your home, you can't. We protect you even from yourself and your bad decisions. Why can't we have that same ideology apply when we look around at drug addicts who really aren't thinking for themselves? And when somebody like Whitney Houston or Johnny Jones dies because we watched them, you know, self-destruct, why can't we say to ourselves, that is not freedom?
Yeah, that's for sure. Wendy Murphy's here. I have proven myself to be a fit and loving parent. I'm poaching from your article at the Patriot Ledger, talking about this Josh Powell, those poor little boys, Braden and Charlie, in the system. We all know, and I've covered it, you've covered it, the disappearance of Susan Powell for a couple of years now, and we've heard the story, the social worker bringing the kids for a visit, and I'm going to throw it to you. Let's take it from there. What happened? What went wrong?
Well, where to begin? The nature of the family court system in the United States is such a mess that I would have to have 5 hours of time to get through it all.
Right.
But I'll say a couple of very basic points. The sort of low-level, simple observations that are really questions of policy and procedure are, why would a guy like this be allowed to have visits at his own home when everybody around him and everyone who knew the case said, this isn't safe? Because we already have visitation centers in every state in this country. If you have a domestic violence situation, whether it's domestic violence between the parents or involving some kind of child abuse or child sexual abuse, generally speaking, courts order any visitation, if there is to be visitation, to occur at a visitation center where there are neutral parties and there's kind of, you know, there's oversight and there are people there and there's security. So neither parent, whether it's male or female, neither parent can actually indulge whatever, you know, feelings they have that are full of rage because of the tension of the divorce case. That's been around for a long time, the concept of visitation centers. Why that wasn't in place here escapes me. I don't know. It was a tragic mistake, but it was also just plain stupidity on the part of the court. Where does that stupidity come from raises questions at a higher level, not so much a policy and procedure question, but constitutionally speaking, what the hell are we doing letting any parent, but in this case a guy, have any access to his children when he's under suspicion for killing his children's mother?
Right.
Why should he have any access to his children when not only is he suspected of killing his children's mother, but the children are eyewitnesses to the facts surrounding the criminal investigation? I mean, it's absurd on so many levels. Why would you, if you needed to protect the integrity of a criminal investigation, and the criminal investigation involves murder, why wouldn't you protect the integrity of the case and the evidence by forbidding the suspect to ruin your evidence by influencing your evidence? Here we're talking about two kids, at least one of whom would have been aware enough to observe what was going on. Why would you let the perpetrator, the suspect, have access to the key eyewitness to the murder?
Yeah.
So that's already a problem. And where that comes from, and again, this is more of a constitutional question than a procedural question, where that comes from is this rather absurd notion that because this man was the biological father of these boys, that he somehow had, you know, royal power to command them to appear before him for contact, and that he had trump card power to insist that his children be subjected to his presence because he birthed them, because he donated sperm to their existence. He must somehow be constitutionally entitled to be around them. This is an absurd premise in the family court system that subjects tens of thousands of kids every year to lives of violence. Children are forced in the United States to live with violent men, almost always. Sometimes it's women, mostly men.
Right.
Children who are abused are forced to live with the men who abuse them because the man is biologically their father. That is sick. That is sick. Fatherhood has nothing to do with biology. It has everything to do with behavior. But we in this country, the United States is particularly bad about it, are so stuck on the idea that if you are the father, particularly the biological father, but if you are the legal father, you can, in a sense, command even the kids you rape, abuse, and beat, command them to visit with you. We have that much of a backward sense of perspective in the family court system in the United States.
Why that backward sense, though? It just seems like what you're saying is so much common sense, but then you hit the nail on the head. Then there's that backward sense that seems to take over, and then we see these tragedies.
Well, you know, not every bad father kills his kids or blows them up. I mean, that's
no.
The good news. This is a fairly rare event. But I think the answer involves two responses. First is that historically children have been perceived as the property of their parents. That's our legal system's history. And not only are they perceived as the property of their parents, if you look back in time at how children's rights have evolved, you don't have to go too far back to find out that children were owned by their parents, kind of like slaves, and predominantly they were considered the property of their father. In other words, the mother didn't own them, the father did, because the mother was also owned by the father. So that's our common law history in the United States. We come from that background where the men are perceived to be in charge of the family, in part because they own them. If you own your kid, then you can do whatever you want, and you can't get in trouble for it because you can't get in trouble for harming the thing that you own. That's the backdrop. That's historic, but it's kind of the still an embedded tone in our legal system. And I think the second part is that because Josh Powell was a suspect in a criminal case, that we bend over backwards and fall all over ourselves saying, well, he's presumed innocent. What about the presumption of innocence? The presumption of innocence. The poor guy, we have to presume that he's innocent. This is something, Dana, you and I have talked about many times. You are presumed innocent by the judge in the criminal case and by the jury in the criminal case. The process must presume you innocent because the prosecutor bears the burden of proof. I, as a person not involved in your case, don't have to presume you innocent. I can presume you guilty.
Right.
If you're my neighbor and you are Josh Powell and you've been the suspect in your wife's disappearance and likely death, I can presume you guilty. And that doesn't offend the Constitution. It doesn't offend anybody or anything. Well, when you get pressure on folks to believe that the presumption of innocence applies everywhere at all times, then you get family court judges going crazy. Oh, I have to presume that he's innocent. I'm the family court judge, and I should presume that he's innocent. That's actually wrong as a matter of law, as a matter of policy. It is wrongheaded. But a family court judge that worries too much about the presumption of innocence is going to forget that this man, based on a preponderance of evidence, which is not the criminal standard, but just common sense, look at the evidence in front of you. Do you believe this guy probably killed his wife? If the answer to that question is yes, then you shouldn't give a damn about the presumption of innocence that applies in a criminal court. There's no such thing as a presumption of innocence in family court. But judges don't get that. The family court judges don't understand the presumption of innocence from a criminal court doesn't apply to them. Moreover, if there is cause, reasonable cause, to believe that a person, father or mother, killed the other one. The mother killed the father killed the mother. I don't care about gender. If there's reasonable cause to believe that a parent killed the other parent, then they lose what's called the presumption of fitness parents only have constitutional rights to visit with their children if they are fit parents. That's the constitutional imperative. You have to be a fit parent. You are presumed fit unless and until there is reasonable cause, not proof beyond a reasonable doubt, reasonable cause to believe you killed your wife or husband, at which point you are no longer a fit parent. You have no rights, none. That should be the law. That is Murphy's Law. That is the law that makes sense, and it is the only law that provides even a remote degree of respect for children. We don't abide such a doctrine in the United States. We instead indulge, reward violence, and enable violent men to continue to commit domestic abuse, sexual violence, rape of children, you know, child physical violence. We indulge and enable the abuse because we say to men who do this to the people they're supposed to love and protect, it's okay. Even if you did these horrible things, we will continue to protect your rights as a parent. It is the most crazy system on the planet. It is one of the reasons people around the world say America does not have the best legal system on earth. It has the dumbest legal system on earth because it gives prizes out to men who beat the hell out of their wives and children. That's how most of the people feel about the American legal system in my business.
Wendy, as always, thank you, ma'am.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. That's Wendy Murphy, former sex crimes prosecutor. And she said, Murphy's Law, and you're right. Murphy's Law is right. However, there's always comments, and you can send those to me at dana@scaredmonkeys.com. One of the comments from Red is, Wendy makes a good point. However, also could be said with children who are being adopted with parents who are in the category of dirtbags. You know, they bend over backwards for parental rights rather than doing the right thing for children and getting kids to adoptive parents. Children have a lack of rights because they do not vote. So that's Red's Law and Murphy's Law. And that's Wendy Murphy. We're going to take a break. We'll be back with Clint Van Zandt, former FBI agent, to continue on the discussion of Josh Powell. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. Clint Van Zandt is a semi-regular guest on the program. Always nice to have him, retired FBI agent. His website, livesecure.org. And I thought I'd bring Clint on to continue on our discussion about Josh Powell. Welcome, Clint.
Thanks. Good to be with you, Dana.
Nice to have you back. We'll take a little different perspective, just talking to Wendy Murphy about Josh Powell, but I want to get your perspective. Let's talk about the investigators a little bit. Long time in the business for yourself. You get called to a scene like this. Dad takes the little boys, has a gasoline incendiary bomb, blows the place up. We find out later that they've been hatcheted to, also. We even hear stories now about the cops buying the grave plot just so that son of a bee, Josh Powell, couldn't be buried near those boys. Let's talk about the perspective of those investigators.
Yeah, I think it's been a continuing challenge for investigators. These are probably the most frustrating cases one can be involved in. You know, you and I think, for example, the many cases of usually, unfortunately, missing girlfriends and missing wives, like, for example, former police sergeant Drew Peterson, who, you know, suspect in the disappearance and of one wife and the death of another. In this case, Susan Powell, I think that, you know, Josh, husband Josh, was an obvious person of interest from the very beginning. These trumped-up stories that his perverted father, as well as himself, has come up with over, you know, the last couple of years since she disappeared, December 6, 2009, as you well know, computers that were related to Josh were found to have over hundreds, so over 400 sex and incest type of, described as incest type photos on these computers. And again, this is the same type of thing that Josh's father was charged with. So in this particular case, the nut doesn't fall too far from the tree, it appears. What to me, Dana, what is interesting from a profiler's perspective, obviously Wendy, you know, would look at this as an attorney and as a prosecutor, But the question has been asked me time and again and again. Number one is, you know, how could someone kill their own children? Well, unfortunately, over the years, I've seen too many cases of that where a child is, you know, sometimes molested. And, of course, there's a long path from molestation to murder. But in this particular case, to, you know, use an axe on them and blow them up in a house, I would suggest that probably he saw himself as a loving father to use the axe first, in essence, instead of the concept that they would burn to death. He would kill them. But why would he do it? I think he did it for a couple of reasons. I think, number one, that he didn't want them to grow up in the custody of Susan's parents. Number two, he knew he was going to lose them, and like in many relationships, it's if I can't have them or you, nobody's going to have you. And I think another terrible reason, Dana, I think he wanted to punish Susan's parents by taking the last living vintage or connection with their daughter that I think he was responsible for the death of. I think he wanted to take those children as a last-ditch punishment of Susan's parents and to take them with him. It's hard to explain why, and of course he's not here to defend or explain to himself, but when you have to give reason to chaotic behavior, you know, you've got to think out of the box, and you have to think like a person like this would, where he may not have seen murder charges closing in on him, because obviously we didn't have Susan's body, but he did see that he was probably going to lose those children. And I think so many other things were going on in his life at the time. So many fingers were pointed at him. This is someone who chose to bail out of life. And unfortunately, when he jumped, he took his children with him.
Yeah, and that's the difficult part. And we'll get into the system itself and how it failed those little boys. Clint Van Zandt is here. Not necessarily with this case, because obviously it didn't happen. But let's look at this from a negotiator perspective and children involved in a barricaded situation, Clint. Let's say that you got called to the scene and there was a Josh Powell or whoever has their two children. And using them as that weapon against whether it's the ex-wife or the parents or whoever, how do you approach that as an investigator? Because, you know, dealing with the nut bar is one thing, but all of a sudden you got a couple of innocent kids in there, that's another
sure.
thing.
And you know, it's always a decision that, you know, I've had to have input in as a hostage negotiator. Is when you have a barricade or a hostage situation, you know, it's like, I guess my analogy, Dana, would be since we had Columbine and other school shootings, as you know, the mentality of law enforcement has changed. It always used to be you would do the old negotiator type of contain, isolate, and negotiate, and you would continue to talk and talk, and if somewhere along the line you heard someone get hurt or shot go off, you'd try to determine the reason, but you were still trying to stabilize, you were trying to minimize that situation. Well, in the Columbine shooting, we learned you can't do that. We learned you have to get in, and you have to keep going forward, and you have to press forward. You have to find that shooter, and you have to put that shooter down, because people are going to continue to die. I think there's an analogy there in a barricade, a hostage situation, especially when someone has their own family. And what we have to be careful of doing is not saying to ourselves, well, I wouldn't hurt my children in a similar situation, so therefore this person won't. You have to do a cost-benefit analysis. What has he got to gain? What has he got to lose? Who might he be trying to punish? And if we think he's suicidal, would he in fact consider taking his children with him?
Yeah.
Now, my hindsight, like everybody else, becomes very sharp when it's 2020, when it's after the fact. In this particular case, though, you know, number one, you know, I would assume your last guest would have suggested, as I would, that once the court makes a decision that here a custodial parent is not going to have access to those children anymore, the last damn thing in the world they should have done is let those children go to a location where he had control, in essence his own home. It should have been done in a courthouse, in a public location, in a motel room, someplace where the authorities, where someone had control. The court had already made a decision. He wasn't going to have those children and he knew this was the last time he was going to have this level of access. Now, do we blame the social worker? Absolutely not.
No,
the court,
no.
Law enforcement, everyone, again, with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, we would have liked to have thought could have backed that idea up. But in this particular situation, if law enforcement had been on the scene, and we know there was a delayed reaction from law enforcement that just breaks my heart when the dispatcher says, I'm sorry, we can't send anyone immediately because law enforcement's tied up with life and death situations.
Jeez.
You know, you'd be screaming on that phone, don't you understand what this is?
Yeah. No, exactly. Clint Van Zandt is here. You know, let's talk about the media coverage a little bit because you do a lot of media work. We've had nothing nonstop Whitney Houston here for the last little while.
Boy, it has been, hasn't it?
And we can take that for what it's worth. You know, 1 + 2 = 3 with that case. But this story and many, many, many others like it can get shelved, can get set aside for a 3.5-hour funeral. Breaking news on someone, and I'm not knocking her talent, don't get me wrong, but where does the system fail from the media's perspective when we cover these sorts of cases? Because we're not hearing what you're saying, what Wendy's saying, what others are saying in the mainstream media. Some of the cable news shows, absolutely, but the system has to be taken to task somewhat for this.
Well, it does, and that's where, you know, the media has always been this, you know, a wonderful entity that could help us, teach us, train us, we could learn lessons from, and unfortunately, it so many times plays to the lowest psychological denomination. You know, with stories, you know, all of the networks make a decision what's going to sell, what are people going to watch, and when I go on like the Today Show many times, we'll talk for half an hour, 45 minutes, I'll talk to a producer on the telephone before I ever do my, you know, 3-minute interview on television. But a lot of times what I will tell the producers there as well as other shows that I do, you know, this needs to be more than just a flash-in-the-pan story. There needs to be something that the public can take away. We need to learn from something like this. We need to benefit. And if mistakes were made, we need to learn how do we do this better. How does law enforcement do it better? How does the media cover it? And how do we as members of the public learn from this and demand that law enforcement and the media do a better job the next time? And I think so much we've become accustomed to sitting back and being spoon-fed what the media declares should be important to us, instead of us saying what we want to hear. And I think that's the tragedy with the media today.
Absolutely. Clint Van Zandt is here. His website, livesecure.org, is one that you need to check out. Getting back to Powell and the whole situation, where does this take the investigation as far as the disappearance of Susan Powell? Obviously, Josh is no longer around. The boys, father-in-law, I guess, of Susan is in jail, some pornography charges, whatever. Is this a case now that is not going to go anywhere?
Well, you know, law enforcement found a few things. As you know, they found that one blanket with blood on it that
right.
was allegedly a comforter with blood on it that was in a storage facility rented by Josh. And the last I heard was that that had been identified as related to this case. We know that there was this wet spot on the floor that some suggested had been blood and had been cleaned up with bleach or something else. We know that a witness has come forward in Sandy, Utah, to say that the morning Susan allegedly disappeared, that Josh and the two boys were in the restaurant. This woman went over to wait on them in Sandy, Utah, asked one of the little boys, asked the waitress, have you seen my mother? And Josh picked up the children and spirited them out. We know that one of the children allegedly drew a picture of the van or of the family vehicle. And when asked where his mother was, he said, in the trunk. So I think all of those things point out to the likelihood that something happened to Susan. The question is law enforcement trying, not it's not a question, but can law enforcement put together some type of path or direction? Now, we found maps that Josh has thrown away of Utah. Unfortunately, nothing's marked on them. You and I know that usually when someone commits a heinous crime like murder, especially a spousal murder, and if they haven't planned on it, the body disposal site is usually some place that they've been to before, some place they know, some place they feel they can get in and get out of without being detected, or if they're seen, some place where they can explain their presence. And I'm sure profilers and investigators have looked at that, but the challenges, again, you know, in my analogy, still goes with the case of Drew Peterson and his young missing wife. Again, Drew Peterson was someone who knew the community, who knew, I mean, cops know where to put bodies so they don't get found. In Josh Powell's case, he had access to a very large rural area, but again, more than likely, it was some place that he knew that he had been to before. Now, for the last 2 years, 3 years, law enforcement has been trying to find that spot. But, you know, there's a lot of mines and wells and shafts and everything else. And unfortunately, it's not that hard to dispose of a human body. And the challenge is, as terrible, as horrible as it was, obviously, for Susan, as it was for her two young boys who did nothing wrong whatsoever and were murdered by their own father, for Susan's parents, to lose a daughter, to lose your two grandchildren in such a terrible, terrible manner. And I think, you know, I think Josh Powell knew exactly what he was doing. He was leaving this last terrible impression in the minds of Susan's parents to punish them until the day they died. And if you put themselves, God forbid, in that situation, from the time they get up to the time they go to bed, Josh is right. That's the only thing they're going to think of. So I can't imagine a more self-centered, selfish, egotistical person than Josh Powell to commit the crimes that he's committed.
Clint Van Zandt is here. Before I let you go, Clint, I want to get your thoughts on apparently a book deal with Amanda Knox.
Yeah.
It should be no surprise to anyone.
I saw it coming.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, I think you predicted it on the show here. What about that? You know, when we look at those, and we will see something from Casey Anthony eventually too, and others. But what do you think about that? Those that have been in the system, let go by the system, and now trying to profit from the system.
Well, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people do that. And when, you know, in her case, when she takes the time she was in jail and divides it by whatever it is, $3 or $4 million, she's probably going to consider that time well spent. As you know, I was in Italy. I spent time at the crime scene. I looked at the physical evidence. I talked to the police officers, the CSI investigators. And at that early time, they made a very strong case for their belief of her involvement in this. Would she have been convicted in an American court? I don't know that she really would have been. I think part of the challenge in that case was that her family and her supporters, unfortunately, went out of their way not only to support her, but to trash the Italian criminal justice system. And I think part of the reason she was convicted the first time was just based upon that criminal justice system was upset with the family, and I think that fell back on her. Now, you know, the court has looked at her the second time. Now, she's not, she obviously hasn't been found innocent. She's been found not guilty of this offense. Big difference between the two. You know, two people know what happened. Perhaps three people know what happened in that offense. You know, we have her, we have her boyfriend, and we have Rudy, the third person who was allegedly at the crime scene, who's doing hard time now. It's interesting that he has never made a statement either exonerating her and her boyfriend or ruling them in or ruling them out. But the bottom line is The criminal justice system has found her not guilty. She's going to be a very, very rich woman now. She has a story to tell. And will reality and her story ever match? She's probably the only one that can ever tell us that. So we have to believe in the criminal justice system. We have to let it run its way. And, you know, am I upset one way or the other? When, you know, I wasn't there when the crime was committed. It was a horrific murder. I saw the crime scene. I saw the blood on the wall where the victim tried to pull herself up. It was a horrific, terrible murder. The victim literally choked on her own blood. So who did that crime? One person, two persons, three persons. Only those who were there right now did it. And this young woman is going to make a lot of money from a situation that she was involved in. And if she's innocent, I'm glad she's out, and I'm glad she got some type of reward. If she's guilty of anything related to this woman's death, I hope every time she looks in the mirror, she knows she's looking at a killer.
Well said, as always. Thanks, Clint.
Thanks for having me.
Talk to you. Bye-bye. That's a retired FBI agent, profiler, hostage negotiator. He's done it all, Clint Van Sant. And when you talk about Josh Powell, you know, all you got to do is just take a look at the pictures of those two little boys. And kudos to the cops that took money out of their own pockets and bought the gravesite next to those little boys so that SOB Josh Powell could not be buried there. Did the system fail those little boys? Absolutely, the system failed those little boys. Can you blame the social worker? Social worker was doing what they were told to do. Can you blame the cops? No, there's only one person that's responsible here, but can the system be held responsible? I think so. I think so. I think there needs to be a serious review when it comes to these parental rights visitations. Take these kids to turf that is not, pro one side or the other. Take it to a neutral place. Make sure there's enough supervision. If we can't protect kids, then who can we protect? As far as Whitney Houston goes, you know, a fan from me, yeah, maybe a little bit, but overblown media coverage, absolutely. Should the family be left to grieve? Absolutely. But we're hearing now that the family is even selling some of the funeral footage. They're saying that the profits will go to Bobby Christina, Whitney Houston's daughter. If that's the way to do it, that's the way to do it. But the media needs to shut off Whitney Houston now. Let the people who want to buy her music, pay for her music, enjoy her music. But there are other stories more important to tell than Whitney Houston. Will we hear what really killed her in the next week or so? Yeah, probably. And I think we can probably all guess. We may be wrong. Maybe there's something medical. But what we do know about Whitney Houston was she was a poster child for self-destruction for a very long time. That's it. That's tonight's show. I hope you enjoyed it. My name's Dana Pretzer. You can go to our webpage at scaredmonkeysradio.com to listen to the show live, pick up podcasts of past shows, and, of course, the daily commentary. Leave comments, drop me an email, do whatever you like to do. We'll see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.